One day, when Victoria Finley was a little girl, she visited a medieval church with her family. It had just rained, quiet footsteps crackled on the wet pavement outside, and on that day, she had an epiphany of sorts.
You know that sparkle in the air after rain? It was that sparkle, and we went in, and I was only 8 years old, and my father took me by the hand.
And he pointed to this massive sapphire blue stained glass window at the front.
And he said, "Toria, look at that." They made that blue window 800 years ago, and we don't know how to make it like that anymore. I thought, oh, there's something to explore. There's a quest in a way, you know, that childhood thing, or actually adulthood thing, where you think there's something to discover. And so I always had this kind of little fantasy of me being the one who discovered the secret of the colours.
Victoria is a colour historian. And that might seem like a pretty particular career path to follow. But what led her to it was a very simple question that occurred to her that day in the medieval church, looking at that stained glass window. Where do colors come from? But Victoria's epiphany, like so many moments of clarity in our lives, was forgotten pretty quickly. For about 20 years, she was an arts journalist. And then one day, she ended up in the basement of a random bookshop, and she opened up an old glossary of colored pigments.
And there were just these extraordinary things. This is the one that really excited me. Indian yellow, made in India by heating the urine of cows fed on mango leaves. I mean, for goodness sake, I mean, that is a story. In fact, I'm going to read you the emerald green. It says the most brilliant of greens, very difficult to match. It is a bad pigment, now universally rejected because it is a dangerous poison. I mean, you know, reading that before I did any of the research, I just thought, it struck me that there were these great stories.
Victoria went on to travel the world in search of where colors came from, and she eventually wrote books and gave talks. Most of us won't go on to become color historians like Victoria. But we're all drawn to color. And that root question, where do colors come from, is something that anyone could wonder about. Just glancing at a book about color for a few minutes brings up so many more questions already. Like, what could make a color bad, and why did people go to such great lengths to make color? But that's just barely scratching the surface. Art is so much more than the finished works that end up on the walls of a museum or in the windows of a cathedral. Behind every painting and every stained glass window, there are stories of the people who produced colors. Of those who heated the urine of cows for Indian yellow and who concocted green poisons for emerald green. It's easy to take for granted the labor that goes into the paints and dyes that make up an artwork. But if you look closely, these colors have great and mysterious stories to tell. Stories of luxury, profit, greed, poison, and of humanity's destructive pursuit of beauty. This is Manual, a podcast about art and its making from the RISD Museum. My name is Emma Vecchioni. I'm an independent audio producer and the host of this first episode, where I'll share four stories about the color green and dig into where green comes from, how it's changed over time, and why we're so drawn to green things. And surprisingly enough, the best place to start to answer these questions might be right in front of us, or rather, under us, grass. Chapter 1, Goose Turd Green. On an early morning, I drove 20 miles south of the RISD Museum to visit Sodco, which is one of the largest grass farms in Rhode Island. They are not putting paint in tubes, but they're definitely making green, and a lot of it. At a place like this, with acres and acres of flat fields, you might expect to hear birds chirping, the sound of whirring lawnmowers, of sprinklers misting the air. But in February, it sounded like this.
Be careful on the steps because we don't typically shovel it because we're not letting people come in this way.
Okay.
In the dead of winter, farmland that's usually covered in lush green grass is blanketed in a thick layer of freshly fallen white snow. Maple trees tapped for syrup line the long driveway at the front, and all of the tractors and mowers sit in big warehouses.
You know, like I said, right now it's all white here. As we see green, it means another season is starting for us. And that also means green is coming in and we're going to start making some money, hopefully.
Pat Hogan oversees the farm year-round. It might seem like a pretty quiet existence to work here in the winter, but the thing about grass is that it's constantly changing.
Typically, mid-May till 4th of July, it's what we call the crazy sod season. We're basically, if the sun's shining, it's 7 days a week here. You come in here at 2 in the morning and there's trucks coming in and out.
In the spring and summer months, the entire farm is booming with business. And Pat works endless hours to make sure his clients get the brightest, greenest grass for their front lawns.
They're renting our land for a year because it takes us a year to grow that grass to what they want to have on their front yard.
But there's one important question at the basis of their entire business. Why do people want green grass so badly?
If you buy a house in suburbia, it has a lawn. In a way, it's the accessory that accentuates the house.
To get to the bottom of this question, I asked my Aunt Gina. She lives in Long Island and is a frequent sod user.
We'll use it all the time because we've always had dogs. And I want them to have fun and I want them to be outside. But they do like these laps. Like they turn into a track and everything gets destroyed. So the sod is a kind of a quick fix that you can fill in the lawn and stimulate the growth again. And it's nice. Grass is nice. Dirt and mud are just not, it's not pretty. And there's something about green, like green, health, outdoors. You're surrounding yourself with nature and, like, you do kind of crave it, now that I think about it.
Green is the color of nature, of grass and trees and fields. But green isn't permanent. When winter comes around, it vanishes. But maybe that changeability, that fleeting quality, is why, in the months that it is around, people are willing to go to extraordinary lengths to get their hands on it, to the point of buying ready-made grass lawns for their homes. For centuries, artists and craftspeople have been trying to capture that grassy green color in nature and freeze it in time so that people could bring it into their homes and make it last year-round. And for a long time, the process of mimicking those rich, earthy hues was a bit peculiar.
What led me to goose turd green is I was actually thinking pretty deeply about a specific work in the RISD Museum collection.
Museum curator Lori Brewer studies the materials that were used to make dye colors in the medieval Netherlands. And recently, while researching a bright yellowish green furniture fabric, she was very excited to stumble upon a color known as goose turd green.
You could say I'm bewitched. To clarify, you were never using goose turd per se. It wasn't a one-to-one, but it was just people were looking for such exact ways of describing their relationship to nature so that you would be using such a kind of visceral, evocative from nature terminology to describe the color of the textile. It's so earthy, and then the materials themselves that would create the color during this time period is just as earthy. In this period, the only dyestuffs that are available are natural dyestuffs. Organic dyestuffs is what they're called. So those are plants. You could use a fern, or you could use something like foxglove flowers to get green, or birch or ash leaves. But to get a green that really is lasting, You use components to build it up.
For much of the Middle Ages, green plants were used to make green dyes. It makes sense. But in Dutch dyeing workshops, which were run in groups called guilds, dyers eventually realized that they could get colors that lasted much longer and more accurately mimicked nature if they mixed blue and yellow plant components instead. That's how colors like goosterd green came about. But there was a problem with mixing colors to replicate nature.
It was actually frowned upon. It was morally a taboo to be mixing or blending colors. If you're blending things that have borne up out of nature, so say a yellow and a blue, that means you're controlling nature. You were falsifying nature, witchery. You know, you've maybe stepped outside of your place in the natural system of things. And it's very, very strictly regulated because the financial wealth of so many nations was based on their textile industry. If you did that, so there's the phrase going medieval on someone. We've all heard it in our literature. There were financial repercussions, but even physical. Dyers could lose a hand.
So capturing nature to create artworks and textiles was a really hard process with really high stakes. People could lose extremities for making colors. But by the 16th century, times were changing.
Dyers are starting to experiment and say, you know, why are we sticking to this structure? Guilds are starting to dare to blend. They're daring to go into a yellow vat and a blue vat to build their colors. So there's some pushback. People are refusing to be told what to do and rising up and using some more self-direction.
As time went on, people took risks to make goosterd green. This bright, earthy hue became so valuable, and people craved it so much, that laws started to change to accommodate it. For a green that could withstand the test of time, witchery was worth it. Chapter 2. Sheila's Green. By the 1700s, the idea of taking risks for green was taken to new extremes. And there was a new kind of witchery afoot. Science. In 1775, a Swedish chemist named Carl Wilhelm Scheele was doing experiments with arsenic. And one day, he was in his laboratory. I imagine him hunched over his bubbling squash-shaped glass bowls, clouds of gray, milky chemicals fogging his view. When suddenly, out of the corner of his eye,
this extraordinary green paint appeared.
In this moment, Carl Scheele was absolutely stunned. Discovering this perfect grassy shade of green was like stumbling on a mythical treasure. At the time in Europe, the textile industry was expanding rapidly, but no one had quite figured out how to make a cheap, chemically made green to dye mass-produced fabrics. Plant-based dyes weren't cutting it anymore. And according to color historian Victoria Finley, there was a real demand for this color.
You know, there was a whole interest in the natural world. It began to happen just as the Industrial Revolution got into swing. People started to move out of the countryside into the urban areas to work in mills. So a bright green, a beautiful, exquisite kind of emerald-like green was something very attractive.
But Carl Scheele was worried.
And he did write a couple of years later to a friend, I mean, an extraordinary letter, really, saying, I wonder whether we should make people aware that this is potentially poisonous. But he didn't.
When Scheele eventually announced his new green color to Europe, there was an explosion of excitement about how amazing it was.
And it became incredibly popular for incorporating elements of the natural world into different elements of design.
That's decorative arts curator Emily Bannis. And because of the lack of bright green pigments on the market beforehand, within the decade, Sheila's green was truly everywhere. It was used to paint fake flowers.
It would have been used in textiles.
It was used to color shoes.
It was used in tendrils on wallpaper.
It was used to dye candle wax, everywhere. For people living in gray, smoggy cities, Sheila's green was the closest thing there was to nature. City dwellers would put up this bright, grassy wallpaper in every room, trying to imitate as best they could the lush, green countryside landscapes that they miss so much. It was as if someone had unfurled strips of sod directly on their walls.
I know that even children's toys were painted in these same green pigments, which was especially problematic when it came to poisonings.
Emily has been researching arsenic wallpaper for over a year now.
To set the scene, when arsenic wallpaper was first being used, people were very used to seeing arsenic and using it in the home for many different purposes. It was readily accessible to buy. It was used in agriculture. It was used in medicine. So the idea that it could be harmful, you know, it took a long time for that to really be instilled in people that actually in these quantities, it could be really dangerous.
And so for a long time, the philosophy around Sheila's green was, as long as you didn't lick it, you would be fine. But problems started to arise.
In 1880, a man called Henry Carr gave a talk to the Royal Society in London, and he announced that one of his young relatives, a boy, after being in a room where his wallpaper, which I think was boys playing cricket on a country scene, had been killed. Another example that he gave of somebody who had almost died was somebody who was ill, who went to the seaside for a rest cure, stayed in, I believe, a hotel where there was this wallpaper. Because it's not just the wallpaper or not just the paint, it's the paint or the wallpaper plus quite a lot of damp. And in the seaside atmosphere where it was damp, that's when the thing came. And a Persian cat locked in a room developed pustules. I mean, it was nasty stuff. And so he said we should stop. You know, the price of this intensely gorgeous colour is too high. A lot of people were kind of positive, but
there were also people who disagreed.
You know, people probably paid quite a lot of money for these wallpapers, I think all of which amounted to finding it hard to believe that they could be dangerous. I mean, I think it is kind of an odd thing to think about, you know, that something as benign as wallpaper could have any serious effect on somebody's health. You know, if I hadn't have done all the research, I probably would have been like, well, that seems kind of strange. Like, people died because of wallpaper.
But Victoria found that there was another, more surprising reason why people disagreed with Dr. Carr at that Royal Society meeting.
I read on the account of it a letter by a Dr. Thudicum, who said that he thought it was worth it. He said, my eyes are happy to see this colour. We're making too much fuss about nothing.
This colour, this bright, beautiful green, seemed to bring out the worst in people. It made some willing to believe that having it and looking at it were worth any cost, even death. When something so beautiful is right in front of you, it's hard to see it for what it really is.
See, it's complicated, isn't it, these colour connections. You've got red, which is love and hearts, and it's also blood and death. Yellow, happy. Gold, kings. Also, you've got bile and sick. We attach what we want to attach, what works for us. It is interesting because this intense green is a chasing of what is natural, and it is utterly corrupt.
Eventually, People across the world accepted that Sheila's green was poisonous, and it was cast aside. But this color ushered in a new modern age where green pigments are mass-produced in factories rather than being handmade from crushed-up plants. And because of that, even today, toxic greens exist. Poisonous substances are used to stabilize pigments made in factories. So popular shades like, for example, Pigment Green 7 and Pigment Green 50 contain chlorine and nickel, which cause birth defects and pollute waterways. Green has become a mythic symbol signaling the natural world. But it's become an empty symbol. And much of humanity has become so wrapped up in its immediate beauty and symbolic gesture that they've neglected the very basis of that symbol. The natural world and life itself. Chapter 3, AstroTurf Green. So there's this movie, Call of the Wild, where Harrison Ford and a dog named Buck go on a treacherous and epic journey through the Alaskan wilderness. In the movie, there's a scene about three quarters of the way in, where the two characters find themselves overlooking this unimaginably idyllic open landscape. The mountains, trees, and grass are all coated in this deep, saturated green. And Harrison Ford turns to his dog, pats him on the shoulder, and says,
"Your ancestors used to roam here, and mine, back when we were wild."
It's the American wilderness as we imagine it. A heavenly paradise, untouched and wild. But if you watch a behind-the-scenes clip of the movie, you'll discover that Buck, the dog, was actually played by a Cirque du Soleil acrobat named Terry, who imitated a dog's movements by walking on all fours using stilts. So most of the movie was actually filmed in a green screen studio, and Terry was edited to look like a dog using CGI technology. The whole heavenly natural environment was actually built in this studio. But what this shows is that the greenest, most pristine-looking landscapes can sometimes be a mask. They hide things.
Everything that looks like beautiful wilderness, like it's perfectly natural, is often the least natural thing and the most far away from a kind of pristine, perfect state as possible.
Art historian Sean Nesselrode-Mancata researches artistic representations of the American landscape. Recently, he studied a lithograph print called The Pastoral or Arcadian State by contemporary Mexican-American artist Enrique Chagoya. In the image, Chagoya illustrates a bright sun, a blue sky, and everywhere this saturated green landscape.
It's like the Windows, you know, default background, you know, that beautiful green hill. You can't take your eyes off of it, and the more you look at it, it looks pretty sickly. It starts to look toxic.
It's almost like Enrique Chagoya is trying to make the color green seem like a guy on stilts pretending to be a dog. He wants to reveal the unnaturalness of the color.
I like to think of it as like AstroTurf green, where it's just this kind of artificial replica. And Chagoya is peeling back that green curtain. There's kind of the idea that nature is some way to access some sort of less cumbersome, pre-modern state of being. But the thing is, the whole get back to nature, it presupposes this idea that there is something primitive to get back to. But the nature was never pristine. It was never a wilderness, and it was never completely innocent.
The interesting thing about the landscape in this work of art is that it's not empty. It's populated with portraits of indigenous people, like Moishika, the chief of the Iowa people who were displaced from their land by white settlers. And with these representations, Chagoya, the artist, hints that this so-called great American wilderness wasn't always untouched or wild at all.
Before the colonization of the Americas by Europeans, the landscape was actually quite populated and it was quite worked by indigenous peoples. You have the construction of incredible terraces and fortified cities. There are histories of controlled burning of the landscape to maintain the ecosystem.
Through burning, indigenous people were able to contain underweeds and maintain pathways for walking, which meant that landscapes looked very different from the wild-looking green landscapes we think of today. But if this is true, how did so many of us come to believe in this idea of the landscape being wild?
The colonization of the Americas by Europeans was preceded by virus and disease that decimated indigenous populations. By the time conquistadores and other settlers arrive in the 15th, 16th centuries, you have a landscape that has been fundamentally altered by mass death. The loss of these populations leads to something called ecological release, where in response to this altering of the balance within the ecosystem, you have vegetation that is running wild. You have huge populations of passenger pigeons, for example, that run rampant. And so the effect of this is that many settlers didn't see the indigenous Americas at all.
Instead, they saw something that was overgrown and wild-looking. And because of this, they began romanticizing nature as this uninhabited heavenly paradise.
And of course, what that also necessitates is the continued erasure of the people who were there in the first place. The whole logic of colonial expansion requires the land to be uninhabited. And if it's not uninhabited, then you have to invent justifications for the eradication of indigenous populations.
The wilderness as we know it is a myth created by colonists. As European settlers forced indigenous peoples off of their land, the histories of the way they maintained the land were erased. And as the underweeds grew up and became thick and dark and entangled, the ideal of an uninhabited, lush green landscape became a really convenient mask to settlers that hid the violence they enacted on that land. Nowadays, our relationship with green and the natural world are complicated. Green has become more of a resource, a thing to own than something to live in balance with. But if the color green can teach us anything, it's that things can change, that nothing is permanent.
You can't change history, but you can change how it's told. And I think it goes back to acknowledging the fact that this is indigenous land, that this is a colonized continent. And we can't change the circumstances of how we got here, but we can certainly change how we move forward.
Chapter 4, Desert Green. I live in the suburbs, where green is a lifestyle, and it's everywhere. On walls and clothes and lawns. It's impossible to walk down any street in town without encountering the humming of lawnmowers. And with all that green comes water. Lots and lots of water. Sprinklers whirring at all hours of the night, and water towers looming overhead. But there are plenty of environments that have no front lawns, no sprinklers, not even the pattering of rain. And at first glance, these places seem to contain very little green.
An image is popping into my head from when we were young, growing up in elementary school. We would get these books or curriculum that were not from our area, and these lessons always showed spring with a bunch of tulips coming up and flowers all over the place. And that was nice. We used to color them and look at them. But as I got older, I'm like, That's not spring where we live. We don't have any flowers coming up. My name is Susan Sikekwaptiwa. Ne Sikeku Imana Yano Pi Matiwa. My Hopi name is Sikeku Imana, and it means the yellow light that comes up over the horizon as the sun is rising in the morning.
Susan is an avid gardener and a member of the Hopi tribe in northeastern Arizona. And her homeland has one of the most arid climates in the country.
My homeland is considered high desert. It's just very, very dry and very hot, and it's very flat. You can see for hundreds of miles. But because it's so flat, we get a lot of winds, and that's probably our the hardest thing to live with around here is wind.
This desert landscape is a far cry from the lush green hillsides and mountains that were idealized by early European settlers who came to the U.S.
For the most part, the rest of the people around the country, when it was being settled in other places, didn't consider this place very hospitable. And it was pretty much deemed, you know, let's just go find a better place to settle. So we were left alone for long periods of time. In the more recent times now that we get a lot of visitors, you know, there's a paved road that connects us to I-40. And I think when people come here, they encounter the historic villages. And when they see these places, they're like, how do these people live here? There's no water, there's no food. And where did they go? And the Hopi people are sitting right here like, we're right here. We just kind of moved a little bit further over from that village and we've created new villages.
Over the 2,000 years that they've lived here, the Hopi people have become stewards of the land and they have learned ways to plant crops to fit their environment. Namely, through dry farming, a process where they cultivate crops without irrigating them.
We don't water them. We get an average of 10 inches of rain a year, very minimal. And with climate change, we're seeing that drop even more. We get some snowfall, and we're seeing that less. But whatever rain we get contributes to the growing of food. A lot of people, I believe, in our culture today, American culture, are really disconnected from the land. They're disconnected from the environments in which they live. And so when they look around, they don't understand or really know what this earth can give us, no matter where you live. And so when they see a desolate environment, dry, hot, deserty, there's a big assumption that there is nothing here. But over those thousands of years that we've lived here, we've learned to adapt and live within it and understand it and thrive in it. So a lot of people just see the harshness and kind of move on. But when you are living within difficulty in anything, there's so many lessons available. And the landscape in which we live in offers just as much.
For centuries, artists have strived tirelessly to mimic nature, to find the perfect green. But maybe we don't have to fight against nature to make green. As Susan says, green can exist anywhere if we are stewards of the land.
You know, what really amazes me, our native plants, our Hopi heirloom plants, our traditional bean and corn plants, we put these seeds in the ground and they pop up out of just sand, and these seeds are so resilient. So when you see that green coming out of the earth, breaking through sometimes a crusty top because it's so dry and hot already, they do it. They're resilient, they're so strong, they're determined, and that's what makes me happy, and that's when I see real joy, seeing those plants emerge and continue to grow in this pretty crazy environment. It's magic.
This episode of Manual was produced, edited, and engineered by me, Emma Vecchione, with Jeremy Radke, Amy Pickworth, and Sarah Gans. Thanks to Victoria Finley, Pat Hogan, Gina Esposito, Lori Brewer, Emily Bannis, Sean Nesler-Mancata, and Susan Sakekwaptua for contributing. And special thanks to Bill Miller from RISD's Color Lab. To read this issue of Manual and see some of the artworks mentioned in this podcast, you can visit publications.risdmuseum.org/manual. And you can listen and subscribe to the Manual podcast wherever you get your podcasts.